broken, unreal. I knew it was wrong to look at these women displaying such wanton nakedness, but I couldn't look away. He clearly found these women exciting, sexually attractive, and I knew, even then, that I was nothing like them. I didn't really want to be like those women, but I wanted him to want me, and I wanted him to look at me the way he looked at the magazines. He never did, and in his way, he punished me for what I wasn't and couldn't be. He punished me for being too young and too naive, too adoring and too accommodating. I was a thing to him, even before he and his friends raped me. He wanted to try things, and I was extraordinarily pliable. I didn't know how to say no. It never crossed my mind to say no. This was the price I had to pay, I told myself, to be loved by him, or, if I was honest with myself, to be tolerated by him. A girl like me, pliable and sheltered and unworthy, and desperately craving his attention, did not dare hope for anything more. I knew that. I cannot bring myself to detail the things he did to me before I was broken. It's too much, too humiliating. But, with each new transgression we committed, I lost more of my body. I fell further from the possibility of the word no. I became less and less the good girl I had been. I stopped looking at my reflection in the mirror because I felt nothing but guilt and shame when I did. And then there was that terrible day in the woods, and I finally did say no, and it did not matter. That's what has scarred me the most. My no did not matter. I wish I could tell you I never spoke to Christopher again, but I did. That may be what shames me most, that after everything he did to me, I went back and allowed him to continue using me until my family moved a few months later. I allowed him to continue using me because I did not know what else to do. Or I let him use me because after what happened in the woods, I felt so worthless. I believed I didn't deserve any better. I was marked after that. Men could smell it on me, that I had lost my body, that they could avail themselves of my body, that I wouldn't say no because I knew my no did not matter. They smelled it on me and took advantage every chance they got. 14. I do not know why I turned to food, or I do. I was lonely and scared, and food offered an immediate satisfaction. Food offered comfort when I needed to be comforted and did not know how to ask for what I needed from those who loved me. Food tasted good and made me feel better. Food was the one thing within my reach. Until I started gaining weight, I had a healthy attitude toward food. My mother is not a woman with a passion for cooking, but she harbors an intense passion for her family. Throughout my childhood, she prepared healthy, well-rounded meals for us, which we ate together at the dinner table. There were no rushed dinners sitting in front of the television or standing at the kitchen counter. We kids eagerly talked about our latest school projects, like a suspension bridge made out of balsa wood or a baking soda volcano. We shared our accomplishments, like a good report card, which was, of course, the expectation, or a goal scored in a soccer match. My brothers and I bickered toward the end of dinner, usually over who would do the dishes. My parents, Haitian immigrants, talked about things we only half understood, like the American neighbors or my father's latest construction project. We talked about the goings-on of the world. We talked about what we wanted for ourselves. I took it for granted that this is what all families did, come together and become an island unto themselves, the kitchen table, the sun around which we revolved. The food my mother cooked for us was good, but it was secondary to the way we invested in being so connected to one another. My parents always made it seem like my brothers and I were terribly interesting, asking us thoughtful questions about our childish musings, urging us to be our best selves. If we were slighted, they were offended on our behalf. When we had some small moment of glory, they reveled in it. I fell asleep most nights flush with the joy of knowing I belonged to these people, and they belonged to me. Even as I became more and more withdrawn, my family remained strong, connected in these intimate, indelible ways. I have no doubt that my parents noticed the change in me. They would continue to notice, to worry over me for the next 20 years and longer. But they didn't know how to talk to me, and I didn't let them in. When they tried, I deflected, refusing to take the lifelines they offered me. The longer I kept my secret, the more attached I became to keeping my truth to myself, the more I nurtured my silence. 15. The only way I know of moving through the world is as a Haitian American, a Haitian daughter. A Haitian daughter is a good girl. She is respectful, studious, hardworking. She never forgets the importance of her heritage. We are part of the first free black nation in the Western Hemisphere, my brothers and I were often told. No matter how far we have fallen, when it matters most, we rise. Haitians love the food from our island, but they judge gluttony. I suspect this rises out of the poverty for which Haiti is too often and too narrowly known. When you are overweight in a Haitian family, your body is a family concern. Everyone, siblings, parents, aunts, uncles, grandmothers, cousins, has an opinion, judgment, or piece of counsel. They mean well. We love hard, and that love is inescapable. My family has been inordinately preoccupied with my body since I was 13 years old. My mother, who stayed home to raise my brothers and me, did not teach me how to cook, and I had little interest in being taught. I just enjoyed watching her prepare our meals from the periphery of the kitchen. The efficiency with which she pursued the task always impressed me. Her brow furrowed in concentration. She could hold a conversation, but when something demanded her attention, she hushed, and it was like the whole world fell away from her. She did not enjoy sharing the kitchen space and did not want help. She always wore latex gloves, like a doctor, to avoid contamination, she said. She was known to add a drop of Clorox to the water when washing meat or fruit or vegetables. She washed a dish or cutting board or bowl immediately after it had been used. Save for the aromas wafting from the gas stove, you would never know my mother was cooking. Throughout my childhood, my mother prepared a bewildering combination of foods. American dishes from the Betty Crocker cookbook or the joy of cooking one night and a Haitian meal the next. The dishes I remember, the ones I love most, are Haitian. Legumes, fried plantains, red rice, black rice, griot, or pork marinated in blood orange and roasted with shallots, Haitian macaroni and cheese, everything served with sauce, a tomato-based sauce with thyme, pepper, and onions, and spicy pickled vegetables, everything made from scratch. This was how my mother demonstrated her affection. My mother didn't believe in processed foods or fast food, so I have never eaten many foods people take for granted. TV dinners, Chef Boyardee, Kraft mac and cheese. She was ahead of her time. Her stance infuriated my brothers and me because our American friends got to eat magical foods like sugary breakfast cereals and snack on Cheetos and Chips Ahoy and Little Debbie snack cakes. Fruit is a snack, my mom would tell us. I vowed when I grew up to decorate my home with clear glass bowls filled with M&Ms, and she laughed. The older we got, the laxer my mom became. By the time my youngest brother arrived, junk food had breached the perimeter of our home, though in the moderation entirely characteristic of my parents. 16. At 13, I went to boarding school. We had moved around a lot throughout my childhood, following my father and his successful career as a civil engineer. He built tunnels, the Eisenhower Tunnel in Colorado, subway lines in New York and Washington, D.C., an outfall project in Boston. When my brothers and I visited him on construction sites, my dad would secure hard hats on our heads and take us below ground, so deep and dark, and show us how he quite literally was changing the world. His company was headquartered in Omaha, but whenever his district got a new project, he would be dispatched and off we would go for a year or two, Illinois, Colorado, New Jersey, Virginia, and then back to Omaha we would return. I began exploring boarding schools so I might attend one school for all 4 years of high school. I was, I admit, also enamored with the Girls of Canby Hall series of books by Emily Chase. I would be like Shelley Hyde from Iowa, the fish out of water who still forged lifelong friendships with her new roommates, as they had youthful adventures against the backdrop of their quintessentially New England campus. And then I was raped, and I had to pretend to be someone I wasn't, and I wanted nothing more than to run away. Attending boarding school is how upper-middle-class girls run away, to be sure. If I went away for high school, I wouldn't have to pretend to be a good girl who knew nothing of the world. I could be the nothing I had become without having to explain myself. I could continue clinging tightly, desperately to my secret and my guilt and my shame. Because I was so shy and withdrawn, because of all of the moving around throughout my childhood, the only people I had to leave behind were my family. I didn't have any friends to miss. I didn't have a particular local high school I had been yearning to attend for years. I didn't even know where we would be living for my freshman year if my dad was transferred again. I was only 13, but it was surprisingly easy to decide that I wanted to leave home. I don't know what my parents noticed about me in the year before high school. Since we had moved, I no longer had to go to a school where everyone called me slut. Instead, there were new torments, new bullies, and even more motivation for me to run as far away from myself as possible. I applied to several boarding schools and got into them all. One, Lawrenceville, accepted me as part of the first class of girls to attend the school when it went co-ed, but the thought of attending a school with so many boys was too much. I ended up going to Exeter because my cousin, Claudine, had just graduated from there, and she seemed fine, and the school seemed fine, and because my parents liked the school's reputation. At such a young age, I absolutely took for granted that I would be attending one of the most elite and expensive high schools in the country, if not the world. All that mattered was that I would be able to run away. Left to my own devices at boarding school, I lost any semblance of control over what I put into my body. Suddenly, there were all kinds of food available to me. The dining hall was an all-you-can-eat extravaganza. Certainly, the offerings were generally bad, damp and malodorous, as is the nature of industrially prepared food, but there were vast quantities available. And there was a salad bar, and there were peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and breakfast cereal, and limitless soda machines, and dessert options, and the grill, a campus greasy spoon where, for a few dollars, I could get a burger, french fries, and a frap. And there was the convenience store downtown where I could buy a huge submarine sandwich, and a Woolworths with an actual lunch counter. I could order pizza, and within 30 minutes it would be delivered to my dorm, and I could eat the entire thing by myself, and there was no one to stop me from my naked, shameless indulgence. The freedom of being able to eat so extravagantly and without limit offered me the only true pleasure I knew in high school. I was presented with an orgy of food, and I indulged in all of it. I reveled in eating whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. I reveled in the steam of biting into a salty French fry, and the slick hot ooze of melted cheese on a hot slice of pizza, and the thick cold sweetness of a frap. I craved that pleasure and indulged myself as often as I could. I was swallowing my secrets and making my body expand and explode. I found ways to hide in plain sight, to keep feeding a hunger that could never be satisfied, the hunger to stop hurting. I made myself bigger. I made myself safer. I created a distinct boundary between myself and anyone who dared to approach me. I created a boundary between myself and my family. I became of them, but not. Being at boarding school was also something of a shock to my understanding of the world. I had grown up middle class and then upper middle class, but at Exeter, I encountered students who came from families who harbored generations of wealth, fame, and/or infamy. The children of political scions, Hollywood celebrities, and industrial dynasties. I thought I knew wealth until I went to boarding school, and then I learned what wealth truly looks like. I learned that there are people with so much money at their disposal, they take lavish spending for granted and have no interest in those without the same privileges. I didn't feel inadequate. However lost I was, I knew I was loved and lucky. But I was overwhelmed by how cavalierly these wealthy peers moved through the world and how much was available to them. As I was a black student from a reasonably well-off family, and I was from Nebraska, of all places, the white students didn't quite know what to do with me. I was an anomaly, and I didn't fit their assumed narrative about blackness. They assumed that all black students came from impoverished backgrounds and lived in the inner city. They assumed all black students attended Exeter by the grace of financial aid and white benevolence. Most of the black students only grudgingly accepted me into their social circles because I didn't fit their assumed narrative about blackness either. As a Haitian American, I didn't have the same cultural touchstones. There were few students with whom I had any kind of common ground. As a socially awkward, shy girl, my loneliness became even more pronounced. Food was not only comfort, food also became my friend because it was constant, and I didn't need to be anything but myself when I ate. When I went home for that first Thanksgiving holiday, my parents were shocked, as if I were unrecognizable, and maybe to them, I was. They saw me plainly while looking right through me. I had gained at least 30 pounds in only 2.5 months. Suddenly, I was very round, my cheeks and gut and thighs fleshy in ways they had never been. My clothes, the ones that did fit, strained at the seams. Though I didn't want to go, my parents took me to a doctor who charitably declared that I was blossoming when so much more was happening to my body. He didn't seem overly concerned, likely attributed my weight gain to being away from home for the first time. My parents had no idea what to do, but they were incredibly alarmed and immediately began to treat my body as something of a crisis. They tried to help me without realizing that this early weight gain was only the beginning of the problem my body would become. They had no idea at all about what created the problem. They knew nothing of my determination to keep making my body into what I needed it to be, a safe harbor rather than a small, weak vessel that betrayed me. 17. During the first 2 years of high school, I ate and ate and ate, and I became more and more lost. I started high school as nothing, and then I became less than nothing. I only had to pretend to be the girl I had been when I spoke to my parents on the phone, or when I went home for breaks. The rest of the time, I didn't know who I was. Mostly, I was numb. I was awkward. I was trying to be a writer. I was trying to forget what happened to me. I was trying to stop feeling those boys on and in my skin. How they laughed at me. How they laughed as they ruined me. I remember so little from high school, but in the past few years, as my profile as a writer has gotten more visible, I've started to hear from the kids I went to high school with, and, oddly enough, they all remember me distinctly. They reach out via email or Facebook or at events and ask me, eagerly, if I remember them too. They share anecdotes that make it seem like I was interesting and not as unbearable as I remember myself. I don't know what to make of the memories of other people or how to reconcile their memories with mine. I do know that I developed a sharp tongue in high school. I was quiet, but I could cut someone with words when I put my mind to it. In my free time, I wrote a lot, dark and violent stories about young girls being tormented by terrible boys and men. I couldn't tell anyone what had happened to me, so I wrote the same story 1,000 different ways. It was soothing to give voice to what I could not say out loud. I lost my voice, but I had words. One of my English teachers, Rex McGuinn, recognized something in my stories. He told me I was a writer, and he told me to write every day. I realize now that being told to write every day is writing advice many teachers give, but I took Mr. McGuinn very seriously, as if he were offering me sacred counsel. And I write every day still. The most important thing Mr. McGuinn did for me, though, was to walk me over to the campus counseling center. He saw I needed help and took me to a place where I could get that help. I won't say I found solace or salvation at the counseling center, because I didn't. I wasn't ready. The first few sessions with my counselor, who was a man, were terrifying. I sat on the edge of my seat, staring at the door, plotting all potential routes of escape. I did not want to be alone with any man, let alone with a stranger, in a room with a closed door. I knew what could happen. And still, I kept going back, maybe because Mr. McGuinn asked me to, maybe because some part of me knew I needed help, and I was so hungry for it. 18. I ate and ate and ate at school. At home for breaks, I made a show of dieting and continued eating everything I really wanted to eat in secret. This double life of eating would become something that stayed with me well into adulthood. It lingers even now. My parents tried to figure out why I was gaining so much weight. I had no answers I could share with them. They put me on a medically supervised liquid diet during the summer after my freshman year. Every day, I drank 5 milkshakes that were chalky and disgusting. Of course I lost weight, 40 pounds, maybe more. My parents were pleased that I had gotten my body under control. I went back to school, and my classmates admired my new body, offered me compliments, wanted to hang out with me. That was the first time I realized that weight loss, thinness really, was social currency. Amidst this attention, I was losing my newfound invisibility, and it terrified me. I was scared of so much as a teenager. Early in the first semester of my sophomore year, I lost what currency I had gained over the summer. Within a few weeks, I immediately began eating again, working vigilantly to undo the progress I had made the previous summer. My newly narrowed face plumped up, my stomach strained against the waistbands of my pants. My breasts swelled wildly because not only was I gaining a lot of weight, I was going through puberty. I still held on to the hope that my boarding school life might resemble the girls of Canby Hall, that I would bond with all the girls in my dorm and all my teachers would love me. That was never my experience. Loneliness remained a constant companion. I didn't have many friends. I was awkward and maladjusted around the friends I did have, and most of the time, I was certain they only tolerated me out of pity. I regularly said the wrong things. I invented a boyfriend, Mr. X, and I don't know what makes me cringe more now, that I used this bizarre pseudonym for my invention, or that I invented a pseudonym at all. I couldn't even come up with a credible name for the imaginary man of my dreams. Eventually, the girls in my social circle figured out that I'd described Mr. X based on one of their boyfriends, which was, as you might imagine, incredibly awkward, and they did not let me forget it. I had no fashion sense. I didn't know how to style my hair. I didn't know how to be a normal girl. I didn't know how to be human. It was a sad, sad time. Every day was a crushing disappointment or gauntlet of humiliation. And then, later in the fall of my sophomore year, I began experiencing severe pain in my abdomen. It would keep me up at night, gasping and in tears, alone in a dorm room far from home. I went to the infirmary, which was not known for any kind of competence, and the staff asked me, over and over, if I might be pregnant. That was, in their minds, the most likely problem a teenage girl could have. I wasn't pregnant, but they weren't really interested in investigating further. They sent me on my way each time, not seeming to take me seriously. The medical community is not particularly interested in taking the pain of women seriously. One night, I crawled to the door of the resident faculty member on my floor, a woman who during my freshman year had imitated me in a game of charades by widening her arms and waddling around the room until someone guessed my name as the clue. When she finally woke and came to the door, I was cold and sweating and clammy. Campus security took me to the local hospital, where the doctors discovered I had gallstones. I called my parents, terrified, and my dad told me not to worry. He told me to close my eyes and that in the morning he would be there. I did as he said, and when I woke up, there he was. That is the kind of father he has always been. I had emergency surgery and my gallbladder was removed. It turned out the high-protein diet I had been on for the summer had not done my gallbladder any favors. I spent about 10 days in the infirmary and ended up with a wicked new scar, tender to the touch. During my recovery, I was still in pain, And before long, doctors discovered that the surgeon had left some gallstones inside me, such tiny objects causing so much pain. I was rushed to Mass General in Boston, my first ambulance ride, and I was scared again, but also excited in the way of a child who does not quite understand mortality. This time, both my parents came and fretted over me until I was better. Before long, I went back to school. I had lost weight with all of the sickness, so once again, I had work to do to make my body bigger and bigger and bigger and safer. 19. Though I mostly sat in the counselor's office silently and sullenly, I continued to go to therapy throughout high school. I didn't make a lot of progress, but it was a space where I could escape the pressure of needing to earn good grades at an aggressively demanding school. I could escape from being an unpopular and awkward teenager who was desperately lonely. I could escape from being a disappointing daughter. Eventually, I was assigned to a woman counselor, and she gave me a copy of The Courage to Heal by Ellen Bass and Laura Davis. At first, I hated the book because it included a workbook, as well as cheesy exercises I couldn't possibly take seriously. The language was too flowery and full of affirmations that also made me distrustful. Many of the theories that book espouses have now been discredited, but at the time when I was so scared and shattered, The Courage to Heal gave me a vocabulary for what I had been through. I needed that book as much as I hated it for all the infantile exercises it encouraged. I learned about victims and survivors and trauma, and that getting past trauma was possible. I learned that I was not alone. I learned that being raped wasn't my fault, and though I didn't believe everything I learned, it was important to know such ideas, such truths, were out there. I didn't feel like I was healing, and I didn't feel like I could ever reshape myself into what that book suggested healing looked like, but I did feel like at least there was something of a map I could follow to get to a place where healing felt possible. I needed that solidarity and hope, even if I couldn't imagine a time when I would become whole again. 20. There was one place where I could forget myself and my hurt, the theater department. In high school, I became a passionate drama geek and fell in love with technical theater, all the backstage work that makes any given show possible. When I was working behind the scenes, my newfound girth didn't matter. My shyness didn't matter. I could be part of something without anyone in a show's audience knowing I was part of something. The first show I ever worked on was Little Shop of Horrors, my freshman year. I worked in the sound booth, managing sound cues, and befriended Michael, the handsome young postgraduate student, or fifth-year senior, who manned the giant plant that comes out at the end of the show. At the end of the year, Michael would take me to his prom on a cruise around the Boston Harbor. He was so kind to me, and never wanted anything from me but friendship. That was something of a revelation to me, that a young man could be kind. As a theater geek, I learned how to build flats and paint the taut canvas to look like any backdrop or setting a show needed. I learned how to design sound effects and hang lights and endure the endless hours of a tech rehearsal. I wandered through the musty costume barn to find specific costume pieces, and helped locate or create the props needed for a given show. When I was in the theater, all darkened and dusty, I was useful. I was competent. People told me to do things, and I did those things. I could apply myself to the tasks at hand and forget about the boys in the woods and what they did to my body. I got to watch plays and musicals brought to life. No matter the show, I loved the spectacle and the quirks of the actors who successfully pretended they were so much more than high school students. Our faculty members, Mrs. Ogami Sherwood and Mr. Bateman, had big personalities and a passion for the theater. They held all of us drama geeks in their thrall. Mr. Bateman was notorious for walking around with a tumbler filled with Diet Coke and vodka. He was balding, but what hair he did have was unruly, standing on edge. He favored black turtlenecks. Shortly after I graduated in 1992, he was convicted of possessing child pornography and sending that pornography across state lines. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Mrs. Ogami Sherwood had a thick head of long, curly hair. She was small in stature, but tall in every other way. She tolerated no nonsense, and most of us were scared of her while yearning for her attention. On show nights, I was often a stagehand. I would dress in all black and be part of the invisible machine that keeps a show running. I knew all the lines to any show I worked on, and with the other drama geeks who were as obsessed with theater as I was, we found a way to have a lot of fun and make a little magic. High school was terrible, but in the theater, we created, for one another, a place where we could fit in for a few hours at a time. 21. Camp Kingsmont is a weight loss and fitness camp that, when I attended, the summer after my sophomore year, was nestled in the picturesque Berkshires of Massachusetts. The brochure made everything look bucolic and inviting, so I knew, instantly, not to trust such propaganda. My parents sent me to Kingsmont for several weeks, another attempt to solve the problem of my body. I did not have much say in the matter because they were determined to make me lose weight by any means necessary, and I had learned the lesson that saying no meant nothing, so it was off to camp I went. I hate camping and the outdoors, and I especially hate the woods. The cabins where we campers stayed were rustic at best, and located at the top of a rather steep hill we were forced to climb whenever we wanted to be in the cabin. We didn't get to spend much time in our cabins, though, because the camp was aggressive about making us enjoy the outdoors. The counselors kept us all busy with various activities designed to make us exercise, without expressly feeling like we were exercising. At least, that was the conceit. I always felt like I was exercising. It was a nightmare. Nature walks, swimming, organized sports, and of course, the terrible treks up the hill after dinner and whenever I forgot something in my cabin. There were weigh-ins, and for 3 meals and a snack a day, we ate shitty nutritional food, lots of baked chicken and steamed broccoli and bland versions of normally delicious foods like pizza and hamburgers, designed to further promote weight loss. I distinctly remember an unnatural quantity of Jell-O being offered. Again, I lost weight, but as one of the older campers, I also got to spend time with the counselors, most of whom were only 3 or 4 years older than us. At night, after the younger campers were put to bed, we would hang out around a fire pit behind one of the cabins. It was quietly thrilling to be included in a group in this small way, to feel like I was breaking the rules. When I returned to my real life, home with my parents, I immediately abandoned all the other lessons I had learned and regained once more the weight I had lost and then some. The enduring lesson I learned at Camp Kingsmont was how to smoke because the counselors let us bum cigarettes for them. Smoking was a habit I would lovingly nurture for 18 years. Smoking felt good and always gave me a light buzz. Smoking also made me feel cool when I knew I was very, very uncool. I loved the ceremony of smoking. Back then, I was very much into the performance of it. I bought a Zippo lighter and always kept it filled with lighter fluid. I liked to flip it open and shut against my thigh as a nervous tick. I started with Virginia Slims, or Vagina Slimes as we called them, then moved on to Marlboro Reds, then Marlboro Lights, before finally settling on Camel Lights, hard pack, my cigarette of choice. Each time I got a new pack, I would tap the top of it against the palm of my hand several times to tamp the tobacco, then pull off the plastic wrap and the foil insert. I'd turn one cigarette upside down and then pull out another to smoke. I am sure I learned this little ritual from one of the camp counselors. I loved smoking after a meal, first thing in the morning, right before bed. In high school, I had to hide smoking from faculty members, so I would walk downtown between classes and smoke behind the storefronts of Water Street, looking out onto the murky Exeter River. During those quiet moments down on the water, sitting on gravel and dirt, surrounded by abandoned cigarette butts and beer cans and who knows what else, I felt like a rebel. I loved that feeling, that I was interesting enough to break rules, to believe rules did not apply to me. Like most smokers, I developed elaborate practices for hiding evidence from people who might frown upon the habit, namely my parents. I usually had an assortment of breath mints, gum, and the like on my person. If I was in a car, I would roll all the windows down as I drove, trying to convince myself that this would air me out. It didn't take long for me to develop a pack-a-day habit, and sure, my lungs ached when I walked upstairs, and sometimes I woke up coughing and all my clothes reeked of stale smoke, and the habit was becoming prohibitively expensive, but I was cool, and I was willing to make a few sacrifices to be cool in at least one small way. 22. In the after, I turned to food, but there were other complicating factors. I was never athletic, even when I was slender. I was a child of the suburbs, so my parents enrolled me and my brothers in all manner of sports. Though they were both athletic, I never really excelled at any of the sports I tried, despite dutifully going to practice. In soccer, I was a goalie. To this day, my family loves to recount the story of me sitting near the goalpost, picking dandelions in the middle of a game. I do not recall this, but it doesn't surprise me that the game held little interest for me. Flowers are pretty, and soccer games are long and boring, especially when children, barely cognizant of the rules or the strategy of the game, are playing. When I played softball, I was the catcher, but I was afraid of the ball, how it raced toward me with such force and velocity. I did everything in my power to avoid that ball, which was not at all conducive to my mastering that position. I also had no interest in running around the bases. My ideal version of the game would have had me hit the ball, have someone else run around the bases for me, and never have to play when the opposing team was at bat. At some point, I played basketball, but I wasn't tall yet. The height would come much later, toward the end of my teens, so I had no natural advantage and was not at all adept at making baskets or defending opponents or doing anything required of someone on a basketball court. Again, I had no interest in running up and down the court. The uniforms were not flattering. My favorite position was scorekeeper. I was very good at flipping numbers over each time a new basket was scored. In school, we played dodgeball and tetherball. We did the presidential fitness challenge, and I finished the running portion last nearly every year. A mile felt like it was a marathon. In high school, sports were a significant and mandatory part of the curriculum, which was not ideal for me. I rowed crew and hated the old creaky barge of a boat we used. I played field hockey and was more interested in the merits of my field hockey stick as a weapon. Lacrosse simply made no sense to me. Ice hockey was a nightmare, spending so much time in frigid temperatures trying to balance on two narrow blades while also basically playing soccer on ice with a small puck and awkward hockey sticks. I quickly concluded that I was allergic to sports. I still hold fast to this conclusion. I was, however, a decent swimmer. I loved the water, the freedom of moving through it, feeling weightless. I loved being able to do things with my body in water that would never be possible on land. I even enjoyed the smell of chlorine. I once set a school record for the 50-yard freestyle. To be clear, this was in the sixth grade, but I still feel a small rush of accomplishment at the memory because in water, using my muscles and my lungs, I was capable and strong and free. My brothers, far more athletic, both took to soccer, my middle brother going so far as to play professionally for several years. I envied their palpable enjoyment of the sport, of athleticism, but I did not really covet that enjoyment. I've always been a woman of contradiction. My true loves were and still are books and writing stories and daydreaming. Sports were merely a distraction, keeping me from what I really wanted to do. 23. Throughout high school, I went through the motions, pretending to be the good student at school and the good daughter when I was talking to my parents, as my mind continued to splinter. With each passing year, I became more and more disgusted with myself. I was convinced that having been raped was my fault, that I deserved it, that what happened in the woods was all a pathetic girl like me could expect. I slept less and less because when I closed my eyes, I could feel boy bodies crushing my girl body, hurting my girl body. I smelled their sweat and beer breath and relived every terrible thing they did to me. I would wake up gasping and terrified and would spend the rest of the night staring at the ceiling or reading myself out of my body and out of my life and into something better. There was no rhyme or reason to what I read. Lots of Tom Clancy and Clive Cussler for the pure escape they provided. Harlequin romances because they were so bountiful. Whatever I could find in the campus library. During the day, I went to class, which was, in its way, another kind of escape. Academically, Exeter was intense, way more rigorous than my college classes would ever be. I loved my classes. In architecture, we had to build a vessel that would keep an egg safe if we dropped it from the roof of a building, but we could only use, like, styrofoam and rubber bands. In an English class, every upper, or junior to the rest of the world, had to write a reporter-at-large essay, an in-depth project for which we had to do research and interview sources and immerse ourselves in a topic that interested us. Back then, I wanted to be a doctor, one of the Haitian parent-approved professions, so I wrote about a surgeon who was my family's next-door neighbor. He was patient with my questions and allowed me to observe a surgery over spring break. While I worked on my reporter at large, I felt like I was so much more than a lame high school student. I did well academically. That's how I had been raised, to be excellent, to never be satisfied with anything less. A B was a bad grade, and if I received an A minus, I could still do better, so I did better. I did my best. I was always very high-strung about school for many reasons, not the least of which was a pressure to perform, and the comfort of knowing that schoolwork, at least, was something in my control. I knew how to study and memorize and make sense of complicated things, as long as they had nothing to do with me. I also knew how much money my parents were spending on my education, and so I could not fail. I could not let them down in one more way. I needed, in some small way, to feel worthy of their expectations of me. I became more and more detached from my body, continuing to eat too much and gain weight. I only tried to lose weight when my parents made me or nagged me enough to give dieting a half-hearted try. I didn't care about getting fat. I wanted to be fat, to be big, to be ignored by men, to be safe. During the 4 years of high school, I probably gained 120 pounds. I racked up incredible bills using my Lion card, the school currency system, buying so much food at the grill, buying random crap at the school bookstore because there was a rush of solace when I ate or spent money. As I spent all that money, I was also probably trying to keep up with the wealthy kids around me who had their own American Express cards that they used extravagantly on weekends in Boston and exotic trips over break to Europe and to Aspen. My parents would confront me about the bills, furious at the waste of money, wanting answers for every expenditure, but really, wanting answers for who I had become, so different from the daughter they thought they knew. I had no answers for them. I was all self-loathing for what had happened to me, for what I was doing to my body by gaining so much weight, for my inability to function like a normal person, for the ways I was plainly disappointing my parents. I still nourished my commitment to being the geekiest drama geek ever to drama geek. My senior year, some friends and I wrote and produced a play on sexual violence. We all had experiences with assault that we had shared in one way or another over the years. On opening night, my parents were in the audience, and after, when I found them in the lobby, their bewilderment was palpable. They asked me how I could have come up with such a thing. It was an opportunity for me to tell them the truth of me, but I shrugged off their questions. I continued holding tight to my secret. By the time I had to decide where to attend college, I knew I had to do whatever I could to make my parents happy, to make up for being who I was, for being a disappointment. I dutifully applied to colleges, mostly Ivy League schools, and New York University. I got in everywhere except Brown University, a slight I have clearly never forgotten. I got my acceptance from Yale in the post office at school, surrounded by other seniors who were equally eager to find out what their futures might hold. I opened the envelope and allowed myself a flush of pride. A young white man standing near me, the kind of guy who played lacrosse, had not been accepted to the school of his choice. He looked at me with plain disgust. Affirmative action, he sneered, unable to swallow the bitter truth that I, a black girl, had achieved something he could not. If I had to go to college, and as a Haitian daughter I had to go to college, I wanted to attend NYU, which had an incredible theater program. Unfortunately, my parents were adamant that it would be too distracting for me to go to college in New York City, and majoring in theater was too unrealistic, too fanciful. The final nail in the coffin of my yearning was their worry that the city was too dangerous, a concern that frustrated me immeasurably, because I knew where the danger really lurked, in the woods, behind well-manicured, exclusive suburban neighborhoods, at the hands of good boys from good families. As much as I wanted to attend NYU, what I wanted even more was a break, a chance for all the noise in my head to quiet. I asked my parents if I could take a year off because I knew I didn't have it in me to keep up appearances for much longer. I was a mess, barely holding it together, but my request was refused. Taking a year off between high school and college was not what good girls did. It never crossed my mind that I had a choice in the matter once I was told no. I ended up choosing Yale because they had an incredible theater program, and I wanted to work at the Yale Dramat like Jodie Foster had. New Haven was an hour from New York City, so I could spend the weekends in the city, I told myself. It is, of course, a bit strange to feel put upon about having to attend an Ivy League school, one of the best universities in the world, but I was a moody teenager, in addition to carrying my secret, my trauma. I was in no position to face my privilege, or how I took that privilege for granted. 24. In the fall after I graduated from high school, my parents drove me to New Haven and moved me into my dorm on Old Campus where all freshmen lived. I was in a fifth-floor walk-up in a quad with three other young women. I met my roommates, nice enough girls I would get along well with. My dad bought me a small blue love seat for the common room that he and another father hauled up those five flights. My mom made my bed with brand new sheets and helped me unpack. We went out to dinner before they headed back to Nebraska, where they were moving once again. It all seemed very normal. Before we parted, they wished me luck and encouraged me to work on my problem, my weight, of course, and then I was on my own once more. I have no doubt my parents were afraid to leave me at another school. The last time they did that, I gained a massive amount of weight. I'm sure they were terrified of what would happen in college, of how much bigger I could get. They didn't worry about drinking or drugs because they already knew my chosen vice. Still, they believed in the importance of education, and I think they hoped that I had some sense of self-preservation, that I would embrace the opportunity I was being given and would want to lose weight so I could be more like other girls, so I could be smaller and therefore better. Having attended boarding school, living on campus for the first 2 years, I didn't have any of the typical growing pains associated with going to college. I knew how to take care of myself on a campus, or at least how to make it seem like I was taking care of myself. But I struggled a lot more than I had in high school. I had acquaintances, but no one with whom I felt I could be honest about myself. I was unraveling so much more because there was far less supervision. There were far more temptations and ways to spend my time. New Haven, Connecticut is a very different city from Exeter, New Hampshire, much bigger, urban, with a diverse population. There was so much more food available to me, both on and off campus. I loved going to Atticus, part bookstore, part cafe, with delicious salads and sandwiches. I rarely went to class, and when I was in class, little made sense. A biology teacher informed us that it was his mission to weed out the wannabes from the students who were destined to become doctors. I was weeded out quite efficiently because the workload was outrageously demanding. There were labs and homework and lab reports to be written according to very strict guidelines. In Calculus 3, the math was so complex, so esoteric, it was almost amusing. The professor may as well have been speaking another language. I changed my major 3 times in 2 years, from pre-med in biology to architecture to English. Meanwhile, I spent most of my time doing theater, as I had in high school. I never tired of being responsible for the quiet choices behind the scenes that make the theatrical spectacle work. My days and nights were spent backstage at the Yale Dramat, and in the theaters of the colleges or dorms anywhere else across campus. I built sets and painted flats and ran soundboards and hung lights. One time, I accompanied a faculty advisor to a private school in Massachusetts to procure a chain-link fence that we'd use during the final scenes of West Side Story. I designed the set for a small college production and served as technical director for a show in the experimental theater. I was able to forget about school, about my family, about my misery when I worked on shows. When I was backstage or in the set shop or up on the catwalk, there were things that needed to be done, and I knew how to do them. Being useful was a balm. 25. That summer, when I was 19 years old, marked the beginning of my lost years, and my lost years began with the internet. When my sophomore year ended, I moved into an apartment above a small specialty grocer with an acquaintance. We weren't especially close, but at the outset, we were friendly enough to believe we could live together. When I started college, my parents gave me a computer, a Macintosh LC2, and a modem. The computer and modem were, purportedly, to help me with my studies, but really, I used them to chat with strangers all around the world, on bulletin boards and in chat rooms and on IRC, an old-school chat program with thousands of channels populated by thousands of lonely people who were mostly interested in talking dirty to one another. I spent most of my waking hours online talking to strangers. I didn't have to be the fat, friendless loser who couldn't sleep, which is how I saw myself. I became immersed in the anonymity and in the ability to present myself to others as I saw fit. I lost myself in feeling connected to other people for the first time in 7 years. Being online offered a very particular and desperately needed thrill. Throughout high school, I had no romantic life to speak of. I was too awkward, too shy, too much of a mess to date. I was invisible to the boys at my high school because of my blackness, because of my size, because of my complete indifference toward my appearance. Because I read so much, I was a romantic in my heart of hearts, but my desire to be part of a romantic story was a very intellectual, detached one. I liked the idea of a boy asking me out, taking me on a date, kissing me, but I did not want to actually be alone with a boy, because a boy could hurt me. The men I talked to online allowed me to enjoy the idea of romance and love and lust and sex while keeping my body safe. I could pretend to be thin and sexy and confident. I discovered forums for rape and sexual abuse survivors where, as with when I read The Courage to Heal, I saw that I was not alone. In those online forums, I saw that horrible things happened to so many girls and sometimes boys. I saw that however bad my secret was, many people had far worse secrets. In IRC chat rooms, I talked to people in the BDSM community, and I learned about safe, sane, and consensual sexual encounters, where power was exchanged, but you could have a safe word to make things stop when you wanted them to stop. I learned that there were people who would take the right kind of no as no, and that was powerful, intoxicating. I wanted to know so much more about safe ways to say no. I had a more expansive vocabulary now for what happened in the woods. At 12 years old, I had no such words. I just knew that these boys had forced me to have sex with them, had used my bodies in ways I did not know a girl body could be used. Thanks to books and therapy and my new friends online, I knew ever more clearly that there was a thing called rape. I knew that when a woman said no, men were supposed to listen and stop what they were doing. I knew that it wasn't my fault that I had been raped. There was a quiet thrill to having this new vocabulary, but in many ways I did not feel like that vocabulary could apply to me. I was too damaged, too weak to deserve absolution. It was not as easy to believe these truths as it was to know them. 26. A couple weeks before my junior year was supposed to begin, I disappeared. I told no one where I was going. Not my roommate, who was increasingly and justifiably fed up with my erratic behavior, or my acquaintances, or even my parents. I flew to San Francisco because I had met a man in his 40s on an online bulletin board, and we had mutual interests. For the first time in my life, I felt wanted, and though I felt no real desire for this man, being wanted was enough. I put my body in danger even though I knew better, but I wanted nothing more than to leave my life as I knew it. I grabbed at my only way out. For all the trouble I've known, I have also been very lucky. This older man was strange but kind. He never hurt me. He never forced me to do anything I did not want to do. He looked out for me and introduced me to other strange but kind people who accepted me as I was, young, lost, and a complete fucking wreck, without taking advantage of me. We went to San Francisco to attend some parties, where I met many of the people I had been chatting with online for months. After a raucous time, he invited me to follow him to Scottsdale, Arizona, a suburb of Phoenix where he lived. I didn't want to return to my life. I couldn't, so I didn't. I had no money, only a few days' worth of clothing. No one who loved me knew where I was. I was thrilled. I felt free because I didn't have to pretend to be the good Ivy League girl anymore for my parents or anyone else. I spent nearly a year in Phoenix. I lost my mind, and I didn't even try to pull the pieces of myself back together. I just did whatever I wanted. I did the kinds of things that the good girl I had long pretended to be would never dream of doing. There was no more pretending I was a straight-A student or a girl who cared about grades, or a good daughter, or a good anything. Completely unmoored from my previous life, I could be a blank slate. I could reinvent myself. I could take the kinds of risks that would have, not long before, been unthinkable. I could complete the break that had long been growing between me and my family and everything I had ever known. I worked the graveyard shift at a phone sex company in downtown Phoenix with a bunch of other lost girls. I mostly sat in my booth and did crossword puzzles while I talked to lonely men who wanted nothing more than the fantasy of a woman who might listen to them for 10 minutes or an hour or two. Around 4 in the morning, on our lunch break, we would get food, greasy, terrible food from a jack-in-the-box across the street. I was fat and I continued to eat to get fatter, and I talked to men without having to be touched by men. When my shift was over, I went home and sometimes invited my coworkers over, and we sat around the pool at this man's house, sleeping with our sunglasses on as the Arizona sun burned into our skin. One day, the man who brought me to Arizona taught me to shoot a gun with wax bullets. It was exhilarating, holding a gun in my hand, the power of pulling the trigger, even if the bullets only hit an inanimate target with a quiet splat. I thought about turning the gun on the boys who had hurt me. I thought about turning the gun on myself. Most of the choices I made during my last year were ill-advised. I was reckless. I did not care about my body because my body was nothing. I let men, mostly, do terrible things to my body. I let them hurt me because I had already been hurt, and so really, I was looking for someone to finish what had already been started. Bottomless. Fearless. This is the reputation I developed in my social circle. One of those things was true. I went home with strangers. One man invited me over while his wife slept on the floor next to the bed where we lay. His floor was covered in cat litter. I can still remember the crunch of it beneath my bare feet as I snuck out the next morning, walked to a payphone, and called the man I lived with to come get me. I started dating women because I naively thought that with women, I might be safe. I thought women would be easier to understand. For a couple of months, I lived with the man, and later I got an apartment with a couple who would end up taking my share of the rent money and never paying the rent. When we were evicted rather abruptly a few months after I'd moved in, I was the only one who was shocked. My parents eventually found me with the help, I assume, of a private investigator. I have never asked. They had my brother, Michael Jr., call me, somehow knowing I would not hang up on him, the baby of the family. We reconnected tentatively. I learned that my father had gone to New Haven and packed up my apartment.